Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. It's Monday, April 9th. What a great day. And it's like part of the Easter celebration. We're still there and we're still in Passover mode. So I guess that's all very good. And then we have a great guest today, Dennis Sheehan. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning. How are you?
It's really a pleasure. You know, I'm getting to see you more often than my girlfriend. So I guess that must mean something. I'm not quite sure what it is. But that's a good thing. So today we're going to be talking about books and everything related to books and publishing and this special extravaganza that came out of your head, Dennis Sheehan. And Dennis Sheehan was thinking of a concept of how to bring about, I guess, book publishers and agents and e-readers and e-writing and just the whole industry. And out of that came germinated, I guess would be a great word, you know, because we're supposed to be literary, you know. this whole concept of putting something together in Yonkers' new downtown that's being refurbished, so to speak, after so many years, and the library, and Susan Taylor from the library system, and Steve Sansone from the Yonkers Downtown Waterfront Bid, and of course the Westchester Guardian, and we're part of that, the Westchester on the Level program and the Yonkers Tribune. So it's like a grand effort to celebrate not only literature and writing and attempts to be literary, you know, and agents and bookstores and the small bookstores and the big bookstores and the, you know, everything. So that's it. Like, I'm so excited about this. So tell us, how did this all come about?
I'm excited as well. How it came about is one conversation I had with you.
Yeah.
And I said I had a concept for Books Without Borders.
Yeah, it's not a great, you know, when you came up with that Books Without Borders, it said, duh, you know, that's, you know, that's the store that went out of business. And mm-hmm. It's almost like a response to that.
Exactly. The publishing industry today, to me, is in total turmoil.
Yeah.
The big guys have circled the wagons around themselves. They've become so
arrogant. Would that be an appropriate word?
I don't want to say arrogant, but They've become very, very insulated.
Okay.
Which has a lot of authors frustrated and angry.
Mm-hmm.
There are 9 million ebooks published right now, mostly self-published.
Yeah.
The reason is that after 2 years of writing 200 query letters and trying to get into publishers and publishers who will now not even speak to an author or accept an author's submission directly. It has mm-hmm. to go through an agent.
Yeah.
The agents have so much business because of that, that they become insulated.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of authors have become frustrated. Now, out of the 9 million, there are a lot of people who just decided they wanted to write a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And they liked the idea that it was published. And a lot of the 9 million self-published books are not really worth publishing.
Uh-huh.
But there are many, many in there.
That are. Yeah.
And they've just been frustrated enough to say, I don't want to deal with it.
Now, jumping on to what you were just saying, it was interesting in the Financial Times this particular weekend was an article about the Italian author who has since died, Primo Levi. So he's a guy that survived the Auschwitz death camps, and then when he came out, he was trained in chemistry, and his mindset was chemistry and the table of different metals.
Table of contents.
Yeah, so he ended up writing around that. That was his mindset. And they were writing, as they revisit his work, that should he want to apply his work now to be published, no one would look at him. And he went through 27 different publishers all over Europe, England and Italy. They wouldn't touch it. And also what's fascinating, which I didn't learn until I spoke to you, was that there are genres. There are like societal norms that are accepted. So, you know, a table of medals and that sort of thing, that would not fit in today's thing. Maybe the genre of horror books and is going out and waning. But, you know, we go through these cycles.
Well, you know what's interesting? There are definite cycles. Look at everything that was published last year.
Mm-hmm.
The majority were vampires.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote the vampire series.
Mm-hmm. That
they made movies out of, has become a television series.
Yeah.
And then everybody wants to write vampires.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is the agents who have close relationships with the publishers and editors say, what are you buying now?
Mm-hmm.
We're buying vampires, we're buying zombies, we're buying... So everything else gets put on the side.
Yeah.
Nothing else is becoming published. And that's part of the problem. Amazon has taken a full advantage of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And they pretty much own the e-publishing industry right now.
Really?
And now they're going into regular publishing, print publishing, which has further infuriated the big guys, the big publishers. I call them the big four, but the big publishers. So there's an outright war now between Barnes & Noble and its Nook and
mm-hmm.
Amazon and the Kindle. And then the print publishers versus the online publishers.
Do people really understand what we're fighting for here? Because we're fighting for market share and money.
Exactly.
Because that's what all these devices are.
But the fight has constricted the industry so much that
correct.
There are so many new and exciting authors that aren't being or don't have the ability any longer to get their work out there.
Right. Because the clutter is too great. You can't seem to get out of that, you know, that little stuff on the bottom. You can't reveal yourself. It's so difficult.
Exactly. You know, this is only my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I view it is the four major publishers have bought out all the other publishers
yeah.
in the country,
mm-hmm.
the decent ones. They call them imprints. But, for instance, you see St. Martin's Press and you see Penguin. They're now owned by one of the big four.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they took these companies over, they reduced the editing staffs.
Yeah.
Now they leave it to the agent and say, we only want a book that is perfect. We don't want to...
They want guarantees, practically.
We don't want to put any money into editing.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put our money into advertising or into distribution. We're not going to deal anymore with the author.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to have our editors sitting here editing a book and going back and forth with an author.
Right.
So the agents have become very restrictive
mm-hmm.
in what they look at. They'll say that they're accepting query letters, and the fact of the matter is, they already know what's topics or genres mm-hmm. that the big guys are going to be buying.
Right.
So anything else that comes in gets put on the side. I'm not saying that they throw it away.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they don't give it the proper amount of attention. But if the big publishers are only looking for zombies and you know, fantasy, horror fantasy, that's all that's going to be really looked at.
And then also, we're also looking at it from a financial perspective, aren't we? Because a publishing house, whoever they may be, maybe, I don't know what the large ones do, but there might be a smaller publishing house that's limited financially to focus only on, let's say, for the sake of argument, 6 books a year. That's all they can afford to promote.
Correct.
Or 12. Or maybe if you're a big firm, you might have 200 under your belt. I have no clue of how much they do. But those are the parameters that they live by. And so a lot of this stuff has been set up through finance. The bean counters have decided which way creativity will go. And it's hurting creativity because not everyone's got that resiliency to keep sending those letters, sending right. those manuscripts in the hope that they'll be, you know.
Exactly right. Advertising budgets have gone way, way down for everybody.
Yeah.
What an author's faced with is once he does get through this maze of impossible
mm-hmm.
walls that are put up for him and does get published, the publisher basically says, we're spending X amount of dollars on advertising, So you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to promote your book, you better promote it yourself.
Yeah.
For instance, my publisher had told me that they were going to do television advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to do 50 spots on television. I thought that was wonderful. Well, the fact was they did. All 50 spots were done between 2 and 4 in the morning on one cable television show,
mm-hmm.
all on the same day.
Wow.
Because they were able to buy a cheap enough space, mm-hmm. and they fulfilled their end of the contract.
Right.
So you can't, as an author, you can't rely on the publishers the way you used to. It's different if you're a well-known author.
Yeah.
And it's different if you're a notable person, like the TV actors and actresses that are all writing books.
Exactly.
They already have notoriety. They have publicity. They have built-in publicity. They have name recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the publishers might take an extra step forward there because they're going to get the maximum amount for their buck based on what these people already have in place.
Correct.
So it's difficult. But I've talked to so many authors, I mean literally thousands of authors that are just frustrated. And I hear the same thing over and over and over again.
Mm.
I've sent out 250 query letters without a response. I've sent 150. I've sent 200. Well, now I just e-publish.
And what is e-publishing? Can you explain that to us?
Sure. You write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several ways to do it. You can go directly to Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And Amazon will just supply you, it's called CreateSpace. They'll supply you with the software. You just type your book into the software, and it puts it into an ebook format, into the Kindle format,
mm-hmm.
with Amazon.
Okay.
Each one of these e-readers has a different format.
Yeah.
The Nook from Barnes & Noble has one format, which cannot be automatically put into a Kindle format.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be reformatted to do that.
Yeah.
You can put it up as a PDF file.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is anybody can steal that on you.
Mm-hmm.
And with a PDF, there's no way to prohibit people from copying it.
Okay.
So if...
It just doesn't work.
If a reading club,
mm-hmm.
Book club, if they want to buy a book, well, if it's in PDF format, one person can buy it and just send the copies of it to everyone else.
Right.
Kindle and Nook prohibit you from doing that.
Okay.
So it protects the author in some way. Now it's to the point that...
And do they promote it, or it's basically the edification of knowing, hey, I wrote a book, I got it into, I guess, some sort of... Because it's a little bit of cachet, so, well, I've been published by Amazon.com.
What most of self-published authors do today,
mm-hmm.
is they've totally dove into social networking to try to...
To promote
their own book.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very time-consuming for them. And it becomes costly because after a while they realize that even though I put 12 hours a day into the social networking,
mm-hmm.
I'm only reaching X amount of people.
Correct.
So then they start to invest in all the different tools that you can use to have your Twitters automatically published.
Yeah.
You start putting up different Facebook pages. You can put ads on Facebook, which cost money.
Okay.
And you're still only getting a very, very small. I haven't seen anyone that's really made it big. I think the number I've read was for every 400,000 ebooks that are published, one person breaks through into the print world.
Really? Yeah. One out of every 400,000? Oh, that's mind-boggling.
It's unbelievable.
So does that mean that had that one individual of 400,000, he or she may have also gone through this process of trying to get an agent to accept their work,
yeah.
and to print. So it's not such a bad batting average if only one out of 400,000 that's able to get beyond the clutter is missed by the system. But I guess there is a need for all of this extra work and creativity, don't you feel? because, you know, you read stuff that you would never have dreamed to talk about. Like, I'm not into the vampire series, so I'd rather read maybe Abby Luby's book about a nuclear story, yeah. Because, you know, it's more interesting, or that might be what interests me that particular day. And so she's got an e-book, but she's not published.
Exactly. And this is the problem. A lot of, and the people that do self-publish,
mm-hmm.
they wind up floating around in the cyber world. Just, unless you know the name of their book and their name,
yeah.
you can't find it.
Right.
So, you know, it's tough. And now that Amazon has actually become a publisher and they're
yeah.
trying to get into print publishing,
mm-hmm.
the print publishers are saying whoever goes with Amazon will never be put into
yeah.
print by them.
By them.
Now, Amazon is going to do the same thing with your print book as it does with the ebook.
Correct.
It's going to be in Amazon. It's going to be posted on Amazon. But unless anybody knows about it, it's not going to go anywhere.
Right.
And
it's interesting, too, that, you know, we're talking basically about clutter. It's been fascinating to watch Apple with the apps. They kept on promoting the apps, the apps, the apps, the apps. And at the end, there are like 50,000 apps. And I understood that only recently, in the last 2 weeks or so, they purchased a company that could somehow catalog it. But you can't even approach the Apple product or any other product that has apps to find out what it is that you want and can use and so on. You have no idea of 50,000 apps. As wonderful as it is, I think it may take three lifetimes to go through what's already available, and they keep throwing more and more up. And that's what's happening with the e-publishing and regular books. You can't find the stuff that really passionately interests you.
Exactly. And all this online stuff, too, has reduced the amount of brick-and-mortar bookshops we have.
Oh, that's the thing that really blows my mind. But while we're blowing my mind, let me just quickly go to the Westchester Broadway Theater, where they blow everybody's mind by all the good stuff that they have, because they're our advertiser, and we got to take care of them. So let's see what we have here. They had a couple of interesting events. Here it is, the Legally Blonde show that they have going. Let's try to get that. Hold on.
As part of their new schedule of more musicals more often, the Westchester Broadway Theater will be opening their brand new production of Legally Blonde on Thursday, March 29th for a hilarious four-week run. Based on the hit film starring Reese Witherspoon, it's the classic fish-out-of-water story of a popular L.A. sorority queen who pursues her ex-boyfriend by enrolling at Harvard University, swapping the sorority in the shopping malls for the rigors of law school with unexpected results. Filled with laughs and a terrific score, Legally Blonde was nominated for 7 Tony Awards, but remember, it'll only be appearing for 4 weeks on the WBT stage. And don't forget, your tickets include a delicious served dinner before the show with a choice of 6 entrees and all for one low price. Order your tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Come watch the cutest little underdog you've ever seen take the stuffy, straight-laced Harvard Law School by storm in Legally Blonde on stage March 29th through April 29th only, and only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, thanks very much. I love the Westchester Broadway Theater. Last month they did a little thing about Swanderful. I kept singing that. And I hated them for it, because like I was singing on the bus, I was singing in the shower, but I really enjoyed the song, so that was really good. Well, we're speaking with Dennis Sheen, who's the author of Purchased Power, and Purchased Power is available at the Dennis Sheehan author.com website. That's Dennis, D-E-N-N-I-S, and then Sheehan is S-H-E-E-H-A-N. And an author, I think everybody knows, AUTHOR.com. And that's about it. So that's really cool. And he's speaking to us about this wonderful event that he's put together and planning for Yonkers downtown. And that's for June 9th, right?
Yeah.
An all-day event and it's free. I love that part, F-R-E-E. I think everybody knows how to spell that, right? Better than Dennis Sheehan author.com. But they know free. And so free is nice because it also includes everybody from young people to slightly older children, and then, of course, young adults and adults and us old folks.
as always.
But before we go on to that, when we talk about the demise of the brick and mortar store, and it was interesting because Mary Marvin, who's the mayor of the village of Bronxville, she was here a few times, and then an administrator as well, Harold Poor III. I always remember him because of the three. So I thought that was the limit, but evidently I met somebody who's the fourth. So like, whoa, and he's a politician. So Peter Tripodi, I think up in Ossining. So he's Peter Tripodi IV. Anyway, but getting back to reality. So one of the things that's interesting is there's a bookstore in on Pondfield Road in Bronxville called Womrath, W-O-M-R-A-T-H. Been around there forever. So I understand, certainly even before my time. But what's interesting about Mayor Marvin is that she said that even though you can possibly get a book by buying it through, Barnes & Noble or through Amazon.com or Books A Million, if they're still in business, I'm not quite sure. There are just so many different companies. It's different than from supporting your local store. And interestingly enough, and this was very interesting, and this is not to take away anything from Amazon.com because they're a very well-respected firm and they serve a niche where you don't have a store. Not every community has a store where you can buy books.
Not anymore.
And interestingly enough, though, those bookstores celebrated the local author and brought the community together by celebrating the local author. Like, I know one of the local authors, for example, around here is Gail Farrelly and her sister Rita Farrelly. I just adore these two. And they're wonderful. They write about different genres. They come from different perspectives. Who would have thought that Rita Farrelly would be writing spoofs when her background is a CPA? I don't know. I never thought they had so much fun. But, you know, when you bring Gail Farrelly to the forefront and you do an interview with her, you say, my God, she was a bean counter. How could she be so lively? But there's something extra in Gail Farrelly. But And then her work, she really is. But the thing that's interesting is that we no longer have that. And then also the part of where the local store used to give to the community. So they would have special events. They might help with a particular program for the community. You don't find the long arm of Amazon.com coming down and plunking down whatever it is they want to do for a community. Such as Bronxville. And it's just because we don't have the mechanism, I think, to do that for a big firm like that, because if you start one, you've got to be all over. And so it's important, as Mary Marvin says, the mayor, for us to focus on that good business person who's there and is part of the community.
You know, people don't realize what a resource a book and mortar bookstore is.
Yeah.
Besides the fact that they're just fantastic to walk around in and just, you know, relax and get all the other nonsense out of your head,
mm-hmm.
and roam around a bookstore for half an hour, but it allows you to see things that you can't see online. Online mm-hmm. is great. If you're looking for a specific book,
right.
and you go online, you get it. If they send it to you, it's going to be the next day. It's what could be better than that?
Yeah.
But you don't know what else is out there.
Right.
When you go to a local bookstore and you start to just to roam around and to look and see what they have, and you say, oh my God, look at that. That's something that really interests me. I want to check that out.
Mm-hmm.
The other resource is that you can't go online and as you can in a book and mortar store and say to someone, you know what? I've been looking for a book on this topic, but mm-hmm. I really haven't been able to find one. And they'll say, well, here's three.
Yeah.
They're attacked in different directions, but right. there's three on that topic that I know of. But you know what? If you can come back tomorrow, I'll see what else I can find for you.
It's interesting because there was a brick and mortar Barnes & Noble on, I think it was on Central Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was near in the White Plains, or maybe it was in Greenberg. I'm not sure. But the thing that was interesting is that when you went there, the people on staff they were well read. These were not just people that came out of the street without a clue, and they could just barely, you know, recite the alphabet. These people were well read. They knew a lot of different subject matter. They also had a machine that helped them get more information about a particular subject because they had more resources. And when you go online, like you say, you don't know. It's like looking for something in the German language, and then you realize, hey, maybe that's not what I was looking for. Maybe I was looking for something similar to it. And you'll see that in the next book.
Exactly.
Or the pretty girl will be standing in that section that you never even thought about because you want to get close to her and find out what she's thinking. So you'll pick up a book next to her and you start to look. You don't find that on the internet.
True.
You know,
it's been a long time for me to do that.
Well, I have to go back. I actually thought prepared for this show. So I had to unravel all this stuff because I don't even remember.
But yeah, you know, you're exactly right. It's a wonderful social environment for
a
bookstore. I was at Village Bookstore in Pleasantville last week.
Oh, yeah.
And I walk in, and the owners give me a big smile. You know, Dennis, how are you? And then I just looked around, and I saw people
Susan
actually.
Susan Taylor from the library, she loves that.
Oh, yeah.
That place.
Yeah. No,
everybody loves
it. They're involved in
the
community. They're involved with libraries.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. People don't realize the close relationships that your local bookstore has with the local library.
We should go into that a little bit more because people don't recognize that. And they also don't recognize the burden of the financial burden that the library system is under because of the transition in the publishing world. And, you know, I'd love if you can go into that because that's one of the things that you're thinking about as well.
You know, it's funny you say that because Books Without Borders has actually organized a seminar for one of the largest book distributors in the country, Baker & Taylor, to present to the librarians, the Westchester librarians, and now it's extended out. Now, Mid-Hudson has joined in, the Mid-Hudson Library System, which are five counties, and we're waiting for something from Baker & Taylor to do. But we're hoping to get the entire New York library system involved in this because ebooks are so problematic for libraries. I mean, think about it. It's not easy to download something to somebody and expect them to return it.
Correct.
Once they download it, it's gone. It's become so costly for them because the ebooks to the libraries are more expensive than
the regular books.
Than the regular books, which surprises me.
Because of the paradigm of trying to charge for each book. And, you know, what's fascinating is that when you go to the regular book, when you find a regular book, you know, it's got a hard cover or soft cover, it doesn't matter, but one of those, it's in print and it's in the library system and they may have it for what? 2, 3, or 4 years, possibly. Others wear out much more quickly, so they reorder. But the point is that they buy the one book, and that goes out as often as it does. So I don't know how long it takes for a hard-covered book to disintegrate because of the number of people who take it out. But when you do the ebook thing, and so they might replace that book maybe once a year or once every 2 years, stuff like that. But when you do it with the ebooks, they charge for every time you take out that ebook. And there's a usage fee, and there may be a limit of 25 for a particular book or 100 for a particular book, and then they have to buy it again.
I was surprised. I just heard one of the librarians. It might have been Susan, but I'm not sure. Was saying that their average cost for an ebook is $70.
I know. Isn't that unbelievable?
I mean, have you heard that?
I heard it from her too, as well.
It was Susan.
It was Susan.
Okay, so I mean that's incredible when you think that you can a hardcover book, which can be used over and over and over again, is $20 or $22, and then you. They're charging $70 for an ebook with a limited amount of usage.
Well, exactly, the limited amount of usage.
Well,
it was interesting too because when you relate that to costs, and there was a moment where evidently somebody absconded money in the library in Yonkers. You know, big story. But whatever, she got caught stealing money. But what was important is that we learned in that process that the library was going to shut down on a Saturday because it didn't have the $60,000 to operate all year long on Saturdays. Can you imagine? $60,000, we didn't have the money. We had to find the money to give them so that they could operate, because, and more so now because of difficult times. But the point is $60,000. And when you have to buy a book like that, it's $70 a clip after you run out through whatever their maximum limit is, and it's not so big. You know, it could be 20 or 25 or 50 or 100. That's a fortune of money.
And here's the interesting part of this whole thing. All of these poor people who are out there e-publishing.
Correct.
Cannot get into the libraries because there's no vehicle for them to do so.
That's the other thing, which is really, really fascinating. And you know what's interesting, too, is remember, after a book has lost its value because of its look and feel and then I guess a paper, they're still really quite good. They're just used. But they could be used again, certainly in your own home, to be able to read it. And then you buy it for $1, $1.50, or $2 when they resell it. That's gone now too, if you charge those $70 for that ebook that's limited, so you're not even getting anything at the back end.
Exactly.
So I mean, it is mind-boggling how everything is so interconnected. I think we've messed things up. I think the good Lord had it set right. We should have stayed there,
exactly.
You know, and the Sabbath, and we should have just stayed with that.
Yeah. You know, but this is the whole purpose behind Books and Borders.
Yeah.
Because by bringing all these people together, getting Baker and Taylor to agree to come to this, to discuss with the librarians programs now that they have to get around these problems or to do away with these problems. But not only that, they're interested to know what the librarians' problems actually are. Because now they can devise their marketing plans and distribution plans according to the needs of the
people. Correct, correct.
So it's a great, and the whole concept behind Books and Borders, booksellers, authors, agents, publishers, distributors, and book designers.
Correct.
Basically everyone in the industry and e-publishers, which I'm sorry I left out, but e-publishers and the online booksellers.
Yeah.
All coming together to find out what each other's problems are, promote themselves, and start to think about where this is all going. Because right now, instead of, when you think about the availability online and what that should have done to expand the industry, it's really constricted it.
Correct. Well, because if you can't say hello to a Dennis Sheehan and shake his hand and say, oh, that was great, while you're eating your bagel, this is a problem.
Exactly.
And the beauty of it.
I remember I did it.
You did.
I did a
you had that.
At a bagel.
I remember. How could I forget?
It was great.
Well, you know, that's the only way I can really enjoy it, because the bagels for a diabetic, evidently the glycemic level goes through the roof. But I just haven't had a bagel in so long, so I can just... You know, just enjoy that moment, you know, when you were at the bagel shop doing your thing. But it would be better, and the venue is so much more beautiful at this wonderful library on the waterfront, the new daylighted river, which is going to be finished by then. They even built a bridge so you could go on from the north to the south and back, you know, which is very nice. We don't have those connections, but this is unusual. I don't know who thought that one up. I think there was a mistake, but it's beautiful. And then you have the Metro North, the Yonkers station, which was designed by the same guy that did the Grand Central station. And then we got the Ella Fitzgerald Park there, which got a little cover, which is great for the kids. And then you got the waterfront and the restaurants. I mean, this is like a wonderful, wonderful little thing there.
It should be a really nice day for everyone.
Yeah. And you know what? You know what's interesting is that I think it's going to be a great event, mostly because it celebrates a part of Yonkers that people don't really know. So it's a discovery, because people have maybe poor perceptions of the city. But certainly that part of the city is trying to revive itself, and it has with a lot of investment. So you've got this Hallmark building, which is the library, and the Board of Education building there, overlooking the daylighted river, which is flowing into the Hudson. You can see the Palisades. There are some really nice restaurants like X2O's and Zupa's and the Dolphin and a couple of other places that opened up.
That's Radiant and
the
Cuban restaurant.
Absolutely. Was it Bella Havana?
Bella Havana.
Yeah, that was good. And then there was an Italian place too. I forgot. Just great stuff. All on Main Street. All in that same area. And then the authors, you know, visiting different restaurants or signing their books, and the best part of all is, and this is the thing that really blew my mind, the only thing that's being charged of those people that, in a sense, take out like a vendor's license, and what's the license cost is like $20.
$20.
I mean, $20 is like a ticket to get in, which is what, but not for the public. No. This is just for the people who are promoting.
Anyone who's selling or promoting.
Exactly. So, and that's like phenomenal.
And, you know, as you know, we were going to fight that. Hopefully the city would have given in on it. But
yeah.
The truth is, one of the authors, when we first started this, one of the authors told me that he was fined.
He was fined.
Evidently, there was a book fair in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And the state fined every one of the authors for not having a vendor's permit.
Uh-huh.
So when the city presented this, I thought, you know what, it better be safe than sorry.
Absolutely.
$20 is a negligible cost.
Absolutely. And no, but you wouldn't get also the notoriety of being there. I mean, the whole idea is it almost is like an imprint of part of your life, and this is part of the promotional aspect that you wouldn't normally get. And just to be able to present your genre, your effort, your baby, say, isn't my baby beautiful? And you hope that nobody will say, well, that's the ugliest baby I've ever seen. But usually people don't say that, you know. But so I think that's a great thing.
So many good things have come out of this. Notable book groups in New York, especially in New York, have come forward and they're participating.
Yeah.
The Marmaduke out of Pleasantville, which is a very, very respected and well-known book club.
Mm-hmm.
They have several best-selling authors belong to that writers group. The Hudson Valley Writers Group.
Yeah.
Also have several probably numerous best-selling authors. They'll be participating. And the Yonkers Meetup Group, which the Yonkers Writers Group, they'll be participating, of course. And interestingly enough, the guy who put that together, his name is Kevin Sheehan.
Mm-hmm. No relation.
My son's name
Far
is Kevin.
Far distant.
But he's a very nice fellow I've been communicating with. So that more and more writers groups, and then people from the industry that I never even thought about.
Yeah.
People who do online marketing specifically for writers.
Mm-hmm.
And who do digital printing. All these different areas of the industry, they're all contacting me and they're all coming together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be informative for the author.
Right.
It'll be a great vehicle for agents to pick up new clients because the people will be there. And it's a great place for the booksellers, the bookstores, even your local bookstores, to see who the new, especially the indie authors are.
Right.
People that normally wouldn't be known. It's going to bring them together. It's going to bring them all together in one place.
Well, I think of it somehow as a Sundance Festival, except it's books.
Exactly.
I mean, to me, it's like, and the beauty of it is that this could be, you know, Books Without Borders. First of all, it lends itself to not just being in Yonkers. It could be up in Suffolk County. It could be up in Connecticut. It could be in Pennsylvania or Michigan or California. It could be in Colorado. What's also interesting is that it could be beyond our border, beyond America, could be up in Canada or Mexico. And, you know, it can really be something that is the personal, business to personal thing, like the Frankfurt Messe in Germany, which is like the place for books, but right. It's publisher to publisher. You know, it's to the industry. This could be to the public, and I think we're going through that transition, aren't we?
Well, this is both. This is,
yes, it
this
is.
This is industry to industry.
Yeah.
And industry to public.
Which I think is the best. I think it's the best because you know the Frankfurt Messe is a little bit too exclusive.
I want to get into that a little bit.
Okay. See, that's why you're so easy to have as a guest. You're getting into it. I'm going to sit back and relax. We should tell people that you're Dennis Sheehan and that I just happen to be here, which is no problem, but this is Westchester on the level. So you go right ahead, Dennis.
This is how far the library system, the Yonkers library system, has gone. They've devoted the entire Riverfront Library to the event.
Yeah.
The Riverfront Library, as you know, is a beautiful five-story building, and the rooms are incredible, and it's just so well equipped.
And it's got the elevators, handicap accessible, a whole bit.
But here are the things that everyone won't know about. This is kind of behind-the-scenes stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We've been able, the library has given us one large room just for the book distributors, booksellers, the publishers, and the agents to meet quietly away from the public.
Right.
So they can network amongst themselves. They've also given us several rooms for agents to bring individual authors, if they're interested in them, to kind of start a discussion about taking them on as a client.
Right.
Away from the public.
And that's also so important because it's so difficult to find an agent.
Exactly.
You know, this is like an entree. This is like a coming out party.
Exactly.
You know, it's like it's phenomenal.
It's gonna let them see you face to face rather than just getting your one page query letter on the email. You know.
Okay.
But there's
like a job interview.
Exactly.
Practically.
Exactly right. That's what it is.
Yeah.
The library is not only opening itself to. There's going to be book readings. There are workshops.
Mm-hmm.
Several of the agents were kind enough to say that they'll lead workshops on how to write a successful query letter, what an agent is actually looking for,
how you
can make an agent more accessible or be more accessible to an agent.
Yeah.
So all those workshops are going to be going on. There'll be private meetings, industry to industry meetings held in private away from the public. And then, of course, then you have the public aspect of all. Booksellers, we have in the atrium of the library will be the Strand Bookstore, Rizzulli's Bookstore, Bronx Fellows, you mentioned warm up, two from Larchmont, and the Village Bookstore, of course.
Yeah.
And each one of them kind of specializes in different things, you know, which is nice. And there'll be children's bookstores, but
I like that too, you know, because people don't always recognize that different stores, different bookstores have a different demeanor about them because they emulate the community that they're in because they serve the community. And that symbiosis between the community and the store is so tight that when you walk into that store, you almost sense it. And that's a discovery and a revelation in itself. And it's something to appreciate when you walk in through that store. You walk into that door and you see a different world. And it may be different than yours, but the similarity is always going to be there because we're all human beings, so we all have that inquisitiveness about us. But it's an exciting moment to realize that you've entered another place.
You know, you said that. The interesting thing about bookstores, if you stand in a bookstore, and I stood in many of them because I'm signing through a book signing, the local bookstore, you know who's from the area and who's not, because pretty much everyone that comes in will be met and said hello to by their name.
Yeah.
If there's somebody from out of the area, you know, you say, you hear "May I help
yeah,
you?"
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, you hear "Hi Joe," "Hi Betty,"
right.
"How are you?"
Mm-hmm.
So they are a part of the community.
Right.
You know, it's interesting to watch this. I myself probably have spent 1,000 hours in the last year just at book signings.
Mm-hmm.
So I stand in bookstores or I sit in bookstores for hours. And after a while, I kind of just sit there observing the people roaming
mm-hmm.
around.
Sure.
But this is interesting to me. The average person that goes into a bookstore, I'll watch them for maybe a half an hour to 45 minutes. They roam around the store. I'm sure they don't spend that much time online looking for a book.
Never.
And they don't have as much access. They don't have interactive help. I mean, there's so much that a bookstore adds to your life.
You know what a lot of people do, and this is, I guess, the thing that really has caused the financial paradigm to falter. As we transition into the age of the internet, there are many people who still thrive, you know, at going to the store, going to the bookstore, finding their way, enjoying all those things that you mentioned, but then pulling away without buying the book there, not supporting that particular community where the book is bought from. And so they lose something in that, because then they will go to the internet and order the book online. And the shame of it all is that it's unfortunate that we're starting to learn that wherever you go, if you like something, you need to support it. It's almost like leaving a tip. It's like buying the book and leaving a tip, but it's.
I've argued this point with a lot of people. I said, why do you buy online?
Yeah.
I've seen these people walk in and out of a bookstore mm-hmm. without a book, and then you know they're going to. I ask them, why
yeah.
do you buy it online?
Right.
It's cheaper.
It's cheaper.
You say, you know what? It's not cheaper.
No.
Because if the book is $16.99
mm-hmm.
in the bookstore,
yeah.
and on Amazon it's $14.99.
Mm-hmm.
It appears to be cheaper, but then you're going to be charged $3.75 for shipping.
Yeah.
So you've actually paid $1 more
mm-hmm.
for the book that you could have booked everywhere when you were in the
right.
bookstore.
Yeah.
But now it's going to be mailed to you.
Right.
There's no difference in cost.
I think there's this assumption that it's cheaper, but I still believe that if you can invest like an hour. And it seems like it's a difficult thing to do, but a lot of people just stare at a screen when they go online with the bookstore, the internet bookstore, but they won't find very much. And they really will go away in a very, very sheltered way. You know what's interesting, too, is that when you go to the bookstore and you ask for help, if you don't know specifically what you want or you're looking for something to intrigue you, then there are those people, those resources right there to help you. But when you go to, let's say, Amazon.com and you buy a few books from them, then they start throwing suggestions at you. And those suggestions limit your mindset so that you can never grow beyond that small little parameter. And then every time you go, and you almost submit to their suggestion and say, okay, let me pick this up. I was happy with this book. Now I'll probably be happy with that book. But it's not always that great experience.
No.
It could be a letdown because your mind just needs more. It needs more than just talking about, I don't know, hugging trees, that you might want to do some other things, like hug a bear or something. I don't know.
So, I mean, for me, it's helpful sometimes.
Yeah.
For instance, I love Clive Cussler.
Okay.
I really do. I think he's just fantastic.
Okay.
I love the guy. And one of the most interesting things, and I've always enjoyed this, he inserts himself in almost every one of his books.
Uh-huh.
I love that. Just somewhere
I like the word insinuate.
It's true. I mean, somewhere along the storyline, the main character will be in some weird place,
uh-huh.
and he runs into a guy, and the guy will say, "Hi, my name is Clive Cussler."
You're right.
I love that.
Yeah.
But that's just my personal taste. I like Clive Cussler. But now if I go on to Amazon, every time I go on to Amazon, it's every new Clive Cussler book that's come out is
right.
printed on my page.
Yeah.
I find that very helpful.
Now, there's a lot of benefit to that, but I think it goes both ways.
It goes both ways. You're right. It puts you into, If I buy, which I do, I buy Clive custom mm-hmm. books. The next month, all I see of, you know, fiction, adventure, mm-hmm. mystery writers. That's it.
Right.
I don't see anything else.
Right.
Where if I go into the local bookstore, and my local bookstore knows I like Clive Cressler, they go, we just got a notice there's another one coming in. Then.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'll be here next Saturday.
Yeah.
And when I go in, I can roam around and look at all the other books that
right.
that might have just come in or the things that are happening. Bookstore is a social, besides being a very helpful venue, it's also a social venue. You see people from your area that you might mm-hmm. not normally see. You run into people that you're happy to run into. And usually the bookstore owners are so helpful.
You don't run into anybody you don't want to see? Because I do.
Maybe
that's my own issue.
I don't have any
business. That's a personal thing. I'm sorry. Did I go too far?
I think so. I don't have those
issues. Okay, that's good. Okay. But don't get into the reporting business.
Oh, God. My son writes for the Post, and he has those issues.
Oh, okay. So it comes with your journalism degree.
I think so. But the whole concept behind this Books Without Borders is to bring the community to the industry and the industry to the community.
Mm-hmm.
So many people don't know how much goes into publishing a book or
right.
how much goes into publishing.
Right.
You know, the fact that we'll be holding seminars throughout the day on distributing, on cover design,
mm-hmm.
on
yeah.
agents, workshops, and basically bringing in every aspect of this industry and everything that a writer has to go through to get his book out there, I think it'll be interesting for people.
I think it's important that people... You know, if people understand the process, they'll also be less personally hurt by rejection because they'll understand what the process requires and that it's not a personal attack on their work sometimes. And I don't think it ever is because there's always a suggestion you can make to improve a product if it needs to go there. And I think there's probably excellence in every effort. Sometimes the execution isn't appropriate. But, you know, there's a way to find something there. The problem is you don't have that interaction because there aren't enough people in the business
exactly.
to tell you. There isn't a time.
This is, to me, this is extremely interesting, and you're correct in what you just said. But I know this for a fact. Every publisher, every agent that edits,
mm-hmm.
they hire an editor who then hires assistant editors. All who write in their style.
Right.
That means that if you don't, as an author, if you don't write in that style, you'll probably be rejected by that publisher or agent.
Mm-hmm.
There's no definitive way to write a book. Of course, you have to use grammar and a sentence structure. And,
mm-hmm.
But an author's voice is an author's voice.
Right.
Some authors write in the narrative, some authors write as conversational, some authors mm-hmm. write in the third person, the first person. It doesn't make any difference.
Right.
As long as they're getting their point across.
Right.
But when it gets to that level on a publisher, the agents look at the style.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not their style or a style that they're comfortable
right.
with, the book is rejected. Most authors don't even know that.
No, they don't.
You know, when an editor from a publisher makes a comment about your book, generally it's just because they don't agree with your style,
mm-hmm.
and no matter what you do, you're not going to make them happy.
Right.
It's best just to get away from that publisher. You know, and that's the truth.
But that takes so much strength. You know, I know you have that strength, but a lot of people don't have that intestinal fortitude. Because there's a sense, you see, you're secure because you're secure in who you are. Publishing and writing was only one aspect of you, but it's not 95% of you, you know. But it's a strong part of you because you're a storyteller and I think you expressed it very well. But a lot of people don't have that, and also you got started at a little later age. A lot of people starting in their 20s and 30s. even 40s, and they just don't have that personal self-respect to say, you know what, I did it right. I got a letter a couple of days ago, a week ago, somebody who's questioning the way I present the stuff in the newspaper, and thinks I cross the line quite often when I do these analyses in politics. And maybe so. And it was a different age. But I think that if you don't, if the editor can't cross the line in analysis, it goes beyond the simple telling of the facts, but taking those facts and extrapolating it, moving it beyond to give people a sense of where you can go with it. Like even in this week's edition, I looked at the financial position of the city of Yonkers. We're in a mess. And then we hear the same old stuff from a lot of people who are supposed to be there to soften it all for us. But is it $89 million that we're in the hole, or is it $150 million? They proved to us it wasn't 89 because they said they forgot this, they forgot that, they didn't put this. These are not CPAs. They're wasting our time. It's $150 million. That's the past, because they won't tell us the truth. They want to tell us what the present is, and they don't know where to go with the future. Because they don't have a plan. It's funny, they're knocking us to pieces with the same old stuff. But we need to go beyond that. You need to have the strength, personal strength, to say, you know what? That's the way. Maybe it's good for them, but it's not good for society as a whole.
Exactly.
And that's the same thing when you get confronted, somebody says to you, this is no good. Well, then think about it and really discuss it and thrash it out. What's wrong with it? I mean, I have writers, and I don't change their voice. I don't change the voice that they want to hear, or that they express themselves with.
I change the way I write. I don't change my voice at all.
Yeah.
And I like the style I write in. And if people don't like it, don't buy my book. It's pretty much that simple.
I think it's nice to be able to learn. You know, like...
But
when you
right.
and I
it's
talk,
it's a learning process.
It's a learning process. I mean, when we and I met, I didn't know you from a hole in the wall. You didn't know me from a hole in the wall. The point is that reading your book and talking to you helps me understand who you are. I never met someone who speaks the way you do, and that's not negative. It's just
I'm
that
Brooklyn.
It's different. Okay, well there you go. So it's that Brooklyn thing. So, you know, so I'm getting in touch, you know, with like my cousins who used to live in Brooklyn that are now in Arizona. So, you know, but I guess that's all part of it. And you get a sense of the differences among people.
You know, it's funny. I have the writer's collection, of course.
Absolutely.
It's in your newspaper.
Absolutely.
And the other authors on.
I love that.
On the writer's collection. And they're very accomplished authors.
Yeah.
When they make a comment to me, I think about it.
Right.
I look back at what I just wrote, and I go, they were right.
Mm-hmm.
Or, screw them, I think they were wrong.
Right.
You know, but generally, I'll go, they were right. And I change it.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing to me is that changes the way I write.
Absolutely.
In the future. Every time.
But that's the beauty of it, isn't it? Is that the beauty
exactly.
of being part of a society? Where you learn from others,
exactly.
You reassess, God help us. That word is like a four-letter word for a lot of people, reassess.
I asked Warren Berger, who's the president of Marmaduke Writers,
yeah.
which I'm not a part of,
okay.
but I respect him as a group. I mean, it's a wonderful group. I'd like to be a part of it. But I asked him if he would do a seminar
mm-hmm.
for authors on the value of belonging to a writer's group.
Yeah.
And this is the value.
Right.
You know, you're getting...
But they never explain that. You see, that's why people stay away. It's like, oh my God, it's so esoteric. Like, how can I even join?
And it's that's true. But, you know, as I said before, you go to a publishing company and...
We're staying here no matter what, even if it is a fire.
Okay. It's not even rejection that bothers you. It's... When your book goes into an editor mm-hmm. and 6 months later they're still editing and you don't know what the heck they're editing and they're sending you back paragraphs and saying, put this paragraph in chapter 7, doesn't even fit. You know, what the heck is this? And after a while you get the sense they don't know what the hell they're doing.
No, they don't.
They don't understand this book. They don't understand me as a writer. They want me to fit my book into their writing style.
Yeah.
And once you understand that, it's no longer rejection. It's a matter of, do I proceed just because I want my name on the front of this book?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I get the heck out of that publishing company and go to another one that,
allow you to express yourself.
Allow me to express what yeah. I was trying to express.
Correct.
So it's more than rejection. I think the problem with young writers is they haven't done anything else.
Mm-hmm.
They graduate from school and they might have part-time jobs and they're trying to pursue this writing career. And they take this kind of stuff as rejection rather than growth.
Right.
And I'll accept it as growth at my age, but they don't. Well, that, and they accept it as rejection and they become extremely frustrated.
Well, that's the beauty of you're exposing yourself. You know, you're putting yourself out there, just even this discussion, because it teaches people the reality. And there may be a different reality when you're 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 and so on. And that's the beauty and the wealth of people who've been around a little bit. And so you, and just sharing that is really the mentoring that's required in a business that is so far removed from most people's minds. All they see is the book. If it ever gets published, and that's all you know nothing else. And you don't even know how you got there. For me, it's like government. So, it's like, how did it go? The process is not explained.
Yeah, you know, here's a great example of what we're just talking about. I have a good friend of mine, and he's a talented author. He's been in public relations for years and years and years. Talented author, but he never really cared about publishing a book. And now he self-publishes.
Wow.
Only because he enjoys it. It's fun.
Okay.
He doesn't care if the book reaches number one on Amazon. He really could care less. He's just doing it because he enjoys it. Now, he publishes through Lulu, which is a self-publishing vehicle.
And right, I've heard of them.
Lulu is probably the best out of that genre of companies.
Right. I think Abby Luby used Lulu.
You know, they're a wonderful company to deal with as a self-publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And he loves it because he'll write his book.
Yeah.
And they print it for him. They do the cover design. It's very inexpensive to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then they print the book as you need them.
Yeah.
So he was telling me, I just talked to him on Saturday. He was telling me he has his books in the local office section in Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he loves it because every once a month they'll get down there and they'll say, do you need any of my books? And they'll say, yeah, we could use five of this one and five of that one and two of this one.
Yeah.
He says, okay, great. And he goes home and he goes online. He orders them from Lulu. They ship direct. And he said he loves it. He has another restaurant that he does monthly book signings in.
Nice.
And this is his thing as an author. He's extremely happy. I mean, to me, that's a successful author.
Yeah, it is.
He has defined his parameters.
Isn't that, though, what an author wants, to be able to express himself or herself, reach out beyond his world through this vehicle, this book, and then connect with other people? Isn't that all it's about?
That's all it should be about.
Well, what else can it be? I mean, he is changing people.
Oh,
just
he is.
By their reading.
He is. And he sells a couple of hundred books a month maybe Walmart in this restaurant.
That's phenomenal. That's success, isn't it?
His books are great.
Yeah.
The books are success. His first book was about his high school experiences on the baseball team.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that book for him, he published it through Lulu, went on to Amazon. A few of people, he's from Mount Vernon. It was Mount Vernon High School.
Mm-hmm.
A few people from around the country now called him and said, oh, my God, I saw the book.
Yeah.
Oh, it's terrific. Oh. Well, that prompted him to organize a reunion. He just had a reunion in the Rye Town Hilton last year in October, and 300 people showed up for this reunion.
Wow.
He then asked them each one of the 300 to write a short paragraph or an essay
mm-hmm.
on what they remember of their high school days
okay.
in Mount Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
And he compiled them all. He edited everything.
Yeah.
And he put that together as a book.
Wow.
And it's a phenomenal history of...
Yeah.
Because these 300 people, their parents owned stores. Everybody knew those stores.
Yeah.
You know, it really brought this community together.
Yeah.
And it was just a wonderful thing.
Well, that's the beauty of the locality, mm-hmm. you know, staying close to home. That's really quite beautiful. Especially like Mount Vernon, I mean, it is the sixth largest city in the state,
yeah.
but we're talking 75,000 people. I don't know how old this man is, but if he goes back like 40 years, let's say. Or,
it's like our age.
Okay, so he goes back 40 years to the time when he was playing baseball. My God, that's like, was it 1970?
Yeah.
About 1970 or so. A lot of people around then, you know, who all remember, and it jogs the memory and brings it back, and they're good memories.
I'll tell you, this is
and Mount Vernon is a nice place.
Now, he's doing this through Lulu.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you how far-reaching it is. I was at a book signing
mm-hmm.
in either Fort Lauderdale or Boca Raton.
Okay.
Either one. I did the two at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But at least four people approached me and said, "Do you know this gentleman?"
Nice.
He's from Westchester, New York.
Okay.
And I said, "Bruce is a very good friend with
him."
His name is Bruce Fabricant.
Mm-hmm.
He's a wonderful guy. But I said, "Yes." I said, "Bruce is a very good friend of mine." "Oh my God! When I was known for Mount Vernon, do you have his books?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Yes, I do have his books."
That's great.
But I mean, he's out there. He's reaching people.
Mm-hmm.
It's all according to what an author wants to do. I mean, I find it frustrating myself. And Bruce and I, this is what Bruce and I were talking about, side action. I put a lot more effort into my books than he has put into his.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have the return for my effort, strictly financially. I have other returns. But
yeah.
I watch my book go from, and this is what drives you crazy. You do have a little too much information, I think, sometimes. My book has been number one on Amazon four times since October,
mm-hmm.
since this past October. But it'll run the gamut from one day it's number one, the next day it's 6,000, the next day it's 26,000, the next day it's 1,000,004 in
mm-hmm.
sales ranking.
Mm-hmm.
And then it shoots back up again.
Right.
And that's because I'm with a small publisher.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the consistency that you can get with a larger publisher.
Right.
Because the distribution isn't there.
Yeah.
That's one. That's the most important aspect in the publishing industry, is distribution.
Because that distribution is how they gauge your placement, right? Based on how many books are being sold?
On Amazon, it's strictly on Amazon.
Strictly there, right.
Strictly on Amazon. But when you have your books out in every bookstore in the country,
mm-hmm.
in every library in the country, Your numbers, your sales ranking numbers on Amazon and on the online companies are going to go way up, because just like you were talking about before, people will go into a bookstore,
mm-hmm.
they see your book, they might be there to buy another book,
mm-hmm.
but the next time they go onto Amazon and they see the little picture of your book there,
mm-hmm.
they go, "You know, I saw that in the bookstore," and they'll take it.
Right.
It means an awful lot in the consistency of the book.
Yeah.
Distribution, if you're with a small publishing company or yourself, if you're
mm-hmm.
self-published, there's no chance for distribution or very little chance
mm-hmm.
for distribution. If you're publishing with a small publishing company like I do, you're very limited in distribution.
Well, a lot of people don't know, and this is very interesting. Wait, it's like, let me play that commercial because we're like at about 11:10. We're speaking to Dennis Sheehan. See, I guess you figured that out already, even though I didn't tell you, because I'm sure they're all whispering, who is that guy? So, okay, so it is Dennis Sheehan, you guessed right. So, and my name is Sissy Harrison. This is Westchester on the Level. And we're going to tell you what's going on at the Westchester Broadway Theater come April 16th, which is right around the corner. So hang in there for a moment.
His hits are truly timeless. His talent has captivated generations of music lovers around the world. He's the Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, Neil Diamond. And on Monday, April 16th, you can experience all his look, sound, and unmistakable energy as the Westchester Broadway Theater presents Brian LeBlanc, starring in Simply Diamond, the ultimate Neil Diamond tribute show, recreating all his unforgettable hits like Sweet Caroline, I Am, I Said, Cracklin' Rose, and so many more. 4 decades worth of unforgettable music. Paul Schaefer of Late Night with David Letterman says, Simply Diamond is the best Neil Diamond tribute show out there. Reaching out. And at the WBT, it's always more than just a show, it's an event. So before the concert, you'll enjoy a delicious served dinner with a choice of 6 entrees. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Enjoy the music and the magic of the one and only Neil Diamond with Brian LeBlanc starring in Simply Diamond, one night only, Monday, April 16th at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, we are back, and we're back with Dennis Sheehan. And my name is Jesse Harris, and this is Westchester on the Level. So that's like a really good thing. And we're talking about distribution, and I think a lot of people don't recognize that when you deal with a big distributor, they're going to work out a deal, let's say with Amazon.com or another bookseller, and the big ones, more so than with the little ones, where they might pay $1,000 for a small table, where when you walk in through that door, you see that book just standing there right in front of you. And it's based on this. I don't know what came first. Was it the supermarket model that brought that about, or was it the bookstore model that brought that about? Because like when you go to the supermarket, and you got the kiddies, the food that the kids love, they're on the lower level because that's what they can see. So they could see the particular cereal that they love, and they see the commercial for that. And the adults have a different level, and so on because of. They figure on height, or they promote that. And like when you go to the detergent aisle, certain products are more prominent because of it's a larger company, and the larger company, in a sense, pays for that real estate on that shelf. Right. And the same thing goes on in the bookstore business.
Sure.
And that means that your book, no matter how wonderful it is and how just what a wonderful read it is, it can't cut through that clutter. It can't overcome, a big author's ability to get it out there.
Exactly. Amazon is a huge distributor.
Yeah,
of their own books,
sure.
On Amazon, when your first page first opens up,
mm-hmm.
and you see all those books that are neatly
yeah.
presented, that space has been paid for to Amazon.
Correct.
That's marketing expense.
Yeah.
And it's not cheap.
No, it's not cheap at all.
It doesn't have any relevance to how good the book is. It's who's behind it. The distribution companies who work to distribute books
mm-hmm.
to brick and mortar stores, to libraries,
yeah.
They all have programs, advertising programs.
Yes.
And a lot of those advertising programs are just what you're saying. They especially in the bigger stores like Barnes & Noble or Borders used to be, they'll buy table space. So they'll buy presentation
That's it.
Space.
Exactly.
Or they'll supply, even more so, I think, that they'll supply displays.
Yeah.
That'll be put up.
And so, that's also extremely expensive. You know, the book covers and the layout and the accoutrements, all the stuff to enhance the book itself.
Exactly.
It's unbelievable.
But it's all part of marketing.
It's like a window. It's like a window at a big department store.
But here's an interesting, I've learned this since I got involved in this business, but if a bookstore buys a large bookstore like Barnes & Noble,
mm-hmm.
they buy 50 books per store
mm-hmm.
of a particular book. And the book turns out to be a flop. Nobody's interested in it. Well, those books will be returned.
Mm-hmm.
Once they're returned, they can no longer be sold as new.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Even though they've never been read,
mm-hmm.
they've only been probably never even, some of them have never left the box they came in.
Right.
But because they've been out there and some of them have been on a shelf and people might have picked them up, they no longer can sell them as new. So it goes back to the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge expense to the publishers. They can sell them as used.
Okay.
And try to recoup some of their money. But they've lost that advertising expense,
yeah.
the placement expense, you know, the display expense. They've lost all that. And the big publishers have found all kinds of ways to try to charge that back to the author, which they normally do.
Mm-hmm.
And
they take it off tax.
And they do.
It's a tax loss.
Right off. But even with a small publisher like myself, knock wood, I'm very happy I haven't had too many returns. But they charge me back for 100% of the return.
Wow.
Not my royalty, for the 100% of my return,
mm.
which is bizarre. I mean, that's a constant fight. I think very few authors can make a full-time living out of being an author because of all this. It's a tough business.
Yeah, it is. Wow.
I'm toying with the idea right now of opening up a publishing company.
Really?
Yeah. Just to face these problems and to try to solve them on behalf of authors. So it's a difficult enterprise. So I'm still toying with it, but I'm hopefully
you'll get there.
I'll get there.
Because that's certainly something that's required. I think because you would embody everything. The only thing that's missing in marketing who you are is just that part, to be able to go that extra mile and actually publish. That's phenomenal.
You know, you wouldn't believe the amounts of money just for a magazine outlet.
Mm-hmm.
I won't mention who it is,
yeah.
but they charge $18,000 per book
mm-hmm.
to be put on the rotary stand as you walk into their store rather than put on a shelf where you can only see the books fine.
Right.
Now, for...
That's per month? I mean, per edition?
It's for a period of time. I think it's for the quarter.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But 18 grand is a lot of money.
Absolutely.
You have to sell a lot of books to make back $18,000 mm-hmm. as an author.
Yeah.
The big publishing companies can afford that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a definite value, believe it or not, there's a definite value of that happening. But there are all of these promotional programs to market a book. A book is a commodity like any other commodity. You know, the big publishers for years have tried to make this cachet that there's something marvelous about, about, you know, the publishing industry.
Yeah.
They're printing books and selling them. It's that simple.
Right.
They first select the book that they want to print. They print the book. They now have a commodity to sell. And how do I sell and distribute that commodity in a cost-effective and profitable way?
Mm-hmm.
That's what the publishers are looking for.
Right. But I guess they're claiming their fame is just the marketing part of it, you know, where they maybe allocate space that they can purchase. But that's what people salivate for. But not everybody is that, you know, Kissinger, you know,
yeah, exactly.
who's going to have the name or the Clinton, and they have the name and they're going to be right. Well, it's, you know, President Reagan's book. Well, no problem, you know, and we'll put up the money.
You know, the publishing industry.
Didn't they give Clinton, Hillary Clinton, didn't they give her $1 million advance just to write the book? She hasn't even started yet.
Yeah, but Hillary Clinton's advance was, that was paid to be published.
Yeah.
Through right. the Center of American Progress, I think.
Yeah.
It was one of
unbelievable.
George Soros'
yeah, yeah,
companies.
Yeah.
But that's a different story. But
right.
for the average guy out there that wants to write a book, the average author.
George is not going to give you a call.
No, definitely not. You know,
or his son.
It's, you know, it's amazing. To me, it's amazing.
Mm.
But the publishing industry for years and years and years developed into this very kind of autocratic and almost aristocratic
mm-hmm.
level of business, when basically it's just taking a book,
yeah.
printing it, editing it, printing it, and selling it. But they developed it, their whole scheme,
mm-hmm.
Or I shouldn't say scheme, but they this whole
method, paradigm and mechanism.
This whole mechanism developed over time so that a book came out, if it's the right publisher, the distributor takes enough copies mm-hmm. immediately to distribute it. Where now, and this is, there are all kinds of places to distribute books without ever hitting the bookstores or the other booksellers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's school libraries, there's
yeah.
libraries, there's all kinds of institutional sales that can be made.
Yeah.
And when you do that, as a big publisher, you can use your clout to push a distributor into selling at that level
mm-hmm.
where initially, the day the book is put out, you've already sold 10,000 books.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you take that and you couple that with the publisher's closeness with the major reviewers from
okay.
the Times,
mm-hmm.
from the Chronicle, Boston Globe.
Yeah.
All of these reviewers salivate over the next book that's coming down from
mm-hmm.
the major publishers.
Yeah.
And that's what automatically a book is published and the distributor buys 10,000 books. They've already made the New York Times bestsellers list.
Yeah.
Get a couple of the good reviewers to, mm-hmm. to review it. And the next thing you know, within 2 weeks, it's a number one bestseller.
Exactly.
Now, once you're a number one bestseller, that perpetuates the sale of your book, of course. That has been lost somewhat to Amazon.
Yeah.
Amazon came up with the thought, the heck with the reviewers, let the people who read the book review it.
Yeah, exactly.
Let the public review it. Those reviews now mean much more to the average book buyer.
Yes.
Than the New York Times bestsellers list.
Well, because somehow the New York Times bestseller list became a little bit too esoteric. It became too clubby.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it just went beyond. And, I mean, we've got one of those wonderful reviewers in the name of John Simon. He does our theater mm-hmm. reviews, but he's also in the Washington Book Review and in the New York Times Book Review and so on. So, but, you know, reading him to me is like, it's like manna from heaven because he's able to put together words that just like flow, you know, like a river, you know, and every word has meaning and makes so much sense. And he's so learned, but he's not above you. He's somehow able to push you a little bit. You know, this is not always an easy read. It pushes, but it gets there and it's beautiful. But like you said, they've taken the average guy, the average girl, and their writing seems to be more important. People also have a sense of that. It's I don't know, is that part of the egalitarianism or something? I don't know. It's like it's common, but I don't know if that's always a good thing. You don't always get like a wonderful review or a good review that way.
But that's okay.
But that's okay because I think they all stand on their own merit.
I don't know how many reviews I have on Amazon or Barnes mm-hmm. & Noble and
yeah.
the online people. But out of the reviews, if people read them,
mm-hmm.
and I have, I mean, actually, the last time I looked, I had all 5-star reviews,
mm-hmm.
which is wonderful.
That's great.
Some of my friends that write, I've looked at their reviews. They have 7 fantastic reviews
mm-hmm.
and 3 terrible reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fine. 7 out of 10 isn't bad.
It's great.
When you're looking at the country as a whole,
mm-hmm.
no matter what you write, you're not going to not everyone is going to like your type of book.
Correct.
But they're not going to like the genre. They're not going to like the way you write. They're not going to like your style. Or they just don't like the subject matter. You can't please everyone.
No.
But as long as you keep pleasing the majority, that's where I think that the notable reviewers, John Simon's a wonderful reviewer. I mean, he's phenomenal.
Yeah. But he's limited too, isn't he? Don't you think? Limited only in the sense that he can only, his product is marketed only in small little niches, you know, like in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Boston. Maybe.
Oh, but so, they control the sales of the country.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they do. But then when you want to reach out to Gary, Indiana, or Wichita, Kansas, they don't always get those reviews.
Well, they do.
They do?
They do, because most of the newspapers in the country,
they're all interconnected, you think, on these things?
No, they buy the New York Times Book mm-hmm. Review, they buy the Washington Post.
Right.
The Washington Post has a separate
right.
A separate entity called right.
I forgot then what they call
Washington Post Community.
Yeah, okay. I think that's what it was. I don't remember exactly.
I think it is. But they have their own
mm-hmm.
reviewers. The San Francisco Chronicle,
yeah.
Another well known.
Right.
They have their own. Well, all these other papers buy them, like syndicated
mm-hmm.
columnists, you know.
Right.
So they incorporate them in their papers every
yeah.
daily or weekly or whatever.
Right.
So, yeah.
It's like the AP, Associated Press, and
exactly.
stuff like that.
But these people have become notable
mm-hmm.
because of the way the industry used to be.
That's right. It's the way it used to be.
They're no longer as notable as they were.
Right.
The online companies have changed the complexion of this industry completely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it would be interesting to see today how much influence they really have.
Mm-hmm.
I know fewer and fewer and fewer people are reading the New York Times Book Review.
Yes, that's right.
I've had people say to me, why should I read that? You know, I can go online and go to the book and I'll see what the people who read the book think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, I guess it's because all those reviewers like the John Simons of the world are regarded as, they've read the book too, believe me. They've read the book and they may have a broader scope of understanding because their reference points span a wider time frame. However, they're also mistrusted, not because they are to be mistrusted. They're very honorable and good people. It's just that our society has come to the point where we mistrust anybody and anyone who is regarded as authority.
I don't know if it's mistrust.
No, it's not.
I think a lot of people today believe that these guys think they're the elite.
Mm-hmm.
They've come out of this publishing industry that is so elitist
mm-hmm.
and basically so closed to everybody.
It is closed, yeah.
You know, well, maybe that. I'm sure that they can tell me if that book is well written or not well written.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not his ideas on what my reading pleasure is
mm-hmm.
might not be as much as I could find online.
Well, that's very true, because I do agree with that. And I think that's a very, very solid point you make there. I think that sometimes they're too well-read, too well-educated, too confined to their world. And they may not realize that I may not be where I can't travel on where they travel.
No.
And I just don't know as much as they do. So I don't always appreciate those nuances.
If you take a look at.
Yeah, we're good.
If you take a look at the four.
We don't ever have enough time. I mean, I'm looking here. It's like, holy moly.
If you take a look at the four major publishers.
Yeah.
That's Knopp.
Mm-hmm.
Macmillan, Simon & Schuster. You know, and Doubleday, which is kind of
right.
Each one.
Now,
of those,
I always know is they pronounce it Knopf.
Knopf.
I think, but for me it's Knopf,
Knopf.
Because that's
yeah.
where I come from.
Exactly.
You know, so like I say, what the hell is Knopf? So I said, well, okay, but sorry, that my own. I had to tell you that. I had to share that.
I mean, they have been the most well-respected and finest publishing
yeah.
company in history.
Right.
There's no two ways about it. They did their job when they... But that was another era. You know,
yes, it was.
I don't think they've progressed, all these companies.
No.
They thought by gobbling up everybody else, that they would maintain what they have. I think it just diluted what they really have. But anyway, that's my own.
Sounds like the newspaper business. It sounds like everything. We've actually gone through that transition period. I think we've hurt ourselves in this lust to financially get things better. But
as a reviewer like John Simon, for instance, think about this now. There were 400 publishing companies.
Yeah.
Now, each one of those publishing companies hired a managing editor or an editor who hired the people below him, and they hired them in the same writing style that they enjoyed or they knew.
Correct.
Which meant pretty much every publishing company, all 400 of them, had their own style.
Mm-hmm.
And the writers that they published reflected that style.
Mm-hmm.
But there were 400 different companies.
Right.
Now there are four. Those four editors want everything below them to be published in the same style that they want.
Right.
The reviewers have become very constricted in what they can talk about because most of the reviewers talked about style by the actual, when they said his writing or their writing, and by writing style, the narrative, the voice of the author. They're very restricted now because all these authors are being pigeonholed into smaller groups.
The choices are no longer there.
The choices aren't there. So what did the big publishing companies do? Well, we'll get entertainers to write books.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Go to a Barnes & Noble's or a bookstore and look in the window, and you're going to see everybody you see in the sitcoms on ABC, NBC, and CBS have just written a book because their names are familiar and they can sell them.
Yeah.
You see very, very few known authors, unknown authors, being premiered by any of these big companies.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want it. They don't deal with them. They don't have to deal with them.
Right.
The big companies have insulated themselves completely. They've relied on the agents. The agents have now become the pre-editing for the majors. The agents have become restricted because they know that they only have to go to one of the four and find out what they're going to buy. So they're going to restrict what they do down to that level. And there are authors that could be the next James Michener. This poor kid is sitting in a blue studio apartment someplace, trying to write during the day and working as a busboy at night.
Yeah.
And he's never going to have the opportunity, or he'll be very, very lucky if he has the opportunity to go anywhere.
Exactly, that's the problem.
It is.
Let me remind people that we're speaking with Dennis Sheehan, and this is Westchester on the Level, and we're going to do one more commercial. We're going to say goodbye to Pat Cooper. You know, he's doing a little thing on April 17th.
On Tuesday, April 17th, the Westchester Broadway Theater will be presenting the final concert appearance by the one and only King of the Belly Laughs, Mr. Pat Cooper. As part of the Pat Cooper Farewell Tour, this legend of comedy will be making his final appearance for his loyal Westchester fans at the WBT on April 17th. It's a never-to-be-repeated opportunity to be a part of the historic close of the career of this New York show business icon, whose irreverent and unpredictable comedy thrilled generations of fans, old and young alike. And no matter how many times you've seen him before, this final WBT performance will be a milestone concert no true Pat Cooper fan can afford to miss. Order your tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. It's your last chance to enjoy one of the greatest ever. So be there to laugh, be there to cheer, but most importantly, be there to say goodbye to this New York comedy legend. The farewell tour of the King of the Belly Laughs, Pat Cooper. One night only, Tuesday, April 17th at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, welcome back. We're just about half hour left over. We're talking to Dennis Sheehan, author of Purchased Power. And you can actually find his book and a little TV commercial preview by going to DennisSheehanAuthor.com. That's Sheehan, S-H-E-E-H-A-N. And, you know, when I call you up on the phone, Dennis Sheehan, somehow or another, because I know that you had a lot of time that you spent in China. And I hear you say Sheehan, and I'm saying, I keep looking at it as X-I-A-N, you know, it's like I'm saying, oh, you know, maybe that's what he's talking about. I'm not sure if you're speaking Chinese or if it's English, but, you know, whatever the case is.
My name in Chinese is Sheehan.
Oh, it's Sheehan. Okay, that's how you pronounce it. And in English, it's Sheehan.
The interesting thing about that is in Chinese, it has two meanings.
It does? I didn't know.
And it's according to
the inflection?
The inflection symbol.
Okay.
You know, it's five inflection symbols.
Uh-huh.
And if you use water, it means hero of the people.
Nice.
And actually, it's three meanings. And that hero of the people, the way it's written, it translates out to hope for China.
Mm-hmm.
The other, though, was very rare or strange.
Well, we don't have to go there. But that's interesting. Very interesting. Well, that's the beauty of, I guess, of your life's experience. It's so vast. It's so broad. You know, it's interesting. The first time we met, you were talking about some experience that you had in Libya about creating these aquifer-fed water. It's like this river that's under the desert.
A lake.
And evidently, you know, I think the Saudis want to explore that. So you were like 30 years ahead of your time. You should give them a call. You got anybody you know in Saudi Arabia?
I
you got to talk to them.
I'd rather write.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. You'll have to write about that.
It's funny. I have my friend Norb Vonnegut, who's going to be one of the featured authors at the Books Without Borders. I've written a couple of things for him on his website called Acrimony, the wild world of finance.
Mm-hmm.
Norb comes out of the finance industry. And I wrote a series on China. It was about four or five articles.
Mm-hmm.
Where China has come from and how they actually got here to where they are today. So about 6 months ago, I said, I've written one on Libya. And I said, I think we're going to have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this article about Libya. And it said that in the article, I predicted that the Muslim Brotherhood would take over the Egyptian government.
Right. Even though they said they wouldn't, they are.
I knew they would. And the same thing will happen in Libya. And I said... And
Libya looks like we've run into a smoldering, quiet civil war. You don't think so? Or
no, I don't. I think...
What's going on there?
It's being... This is my point of view. Mm-hmm. I'm sure. I believe to be... a feeling of unrest is going to continue there until the Muslim Brotherhood takes over Egypt. And then Egypt will completely quiet down and appear to be going in the right direction. And that will be used to take over Libya by the Muslim Brotherhood and unite North Africa.
Right.
Because
at one time, Libya and Egypt were going to be part of one.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I said this 6 months ago in my article, and I said, and you can bet that Iran is going to either close down the Straits of Hormuz or threaten to.
Mm-hmm.
And once Libya is joined with Egypt, they'll close down the Suez Canal, and then our oil prices will totally skyrocket. We won't have any way to get the oil from the oil fields in the Middle East to the United States.
That's a very interesting scenario you point out there.
So he said to me, I think that's a little too over the top for me. I don't want to put this on Acrimony right now. I said, fine. Well, I think he now agrees with me because my predictions
were correct.
But we've come
there. Yeah, we've come there.
It's amazing. You know, I do have a lot of, or I do have, as you call it, depth of knowledge, only because I've lived through in these places and I've dealt with their leaders.
Yeah.
You know, I used to deal on a daily basis with Muammar Gaddafi, and he was a sad case as a human being. But
did you realize that he was? Mm-hmm. People were charmed by him.
He was a very charming guy, but he was also insane.
Mm-hmm.
He had encroaching insanity for a long, long time. He was the product of a rape. He was born a product of a rape, and he was a syphilitic baby.
I didn't know that.
And,
my goodness.
Yeah, he had... An Italian soldier had raped his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the product of a syphilitic baby, and his mind was deteriorating over time.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, he appeared to be brilliant. It must have been like a savant type deal.
Yeah.
And then he just started to go. And I knew in those last years, he was spending most of his time running from bunker to bunker to bunker.
Yeah.
He had all of the Three Stooges movies translated into Arabic.
Wow.
And he used to sit there and watch Three Stooges movies mm-hmm. all day long down in these bunkers. He was really... And it was a mental health issue. It wasn't...
Yeah.
But he was a strong leader, which is what North Africa needs, is a strong mm-hmm. leader. He was of no harm or detriment to the United States. He got the message loud and clear when Reagan bombed
right.
Tripoli and Benghazi.
Yeah.
And he was no threat to us whatsoever. Why this government allowed him to be forced out of office is beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
And not only forced out of office, but to be killed
yeah.
is beyond me. That region was stable. There was no reason for our intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we seem to have backed this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Arab Spring, I think, appears to be an American fabrication.
I thought that myself, but I didn't ever... I don't think anyone's really put a finger on it yet.
Yeah, well, I think it is, and I think it was a big, big mistake. Empowering Iran more than we'd ever wanted to be empowered.
Right. It's literally burned a swath across from the northern Sahara all the way to Iran.
Well, if you look at the way the Ottoman Empire expanded,
yeah,
it is taking the same path.
Absolutely.
It's incredible. And, I mean, it's exactly the same path, except Islam has already taken Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It was the other way around the last time. But
it's interesting, too, the way Turkey has been embroiled when they thought they were ahead of the curve here. Yeah. They thought they were standing on top of the world, and now it looks like they've just also become inflamed by what's going on in Syria.
Yeah.
And amazing.
It's
We should have a Middle East symposium. Oh, that really would be very interesting. But
let's get back to Books Without Borders.
Because I don't think they're going to welcome us, you know, in Syria pretty quickly. You never can tell, but I doubt it.
But Books Without Borders. Now let's talk about some of the entertainment of Books Without Borders.
Oh, yeah. The food.
The 10 featured authors will be traveling from restaurant to restaurant. Mm-hmm. They'll be in each restaurant a half an hour. So if you follow those authors or you just want to meet them and shake their hand or have their book signed, we're trying to arrange it that the bookstores, which will be in the atrium of the library, mm-hmm. will have on hand the books for all the featured authors. So you mm-hmm. can buy them right there.
Right.
And then take them to one of the restaurants and have them sign.
Mm-hmm.
The restaurants will be a nice, kind of intimate, pleasant atmosphere mm-hmm. for the authors to be signing their books.
Right.
Then we have the children.
And all of this is really nice because it's so close.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like a couple of blocks. Two or three blocks. That's it. Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's actually the event location covers, what, six blocks?
Yeah.
So it's all within this area.
Absolutely.
Right in the center of it is the MTA, the Hudson Line. Of
right.
The MTA. So it's easy to commute from the city. It's, what, 20 minutes?
Absolutely. And then from the north part of the county. So, I mean, it's like perfect.
It's perfect.
And you got a train every half hour. And you got the Getty Square, which is only about two blocks away. Is like a central point, so you've got buses from all over the county.
And there's free parking.
And there's free parking. Oh, Buena Vista parking lot, no less.
One of the things, too, that I thought was very generous of the city is mm-hmm. the city has offered all the authors and participants in the event free parking right next to the library.
I mean, is that the best or what?
It was the best.
And that was actually with the help of Kawasaki.
Oh, was it?
That's the Kawasaki plant that's right there behind the Board of Education. And that's their parking lot.
Oh, okay.
That's because they're not working on weekends.
Well, thank you, Kawasaki.
Absolutely. I wish we could have done a better job because we bought a lot of trains, no less. not us specifically, but Metro North, they ended up buying trains and they bought it from Bombardier. I love the Canadians, but hey, you know, we got Kawasaki and Yonkers. They've been there forever.
Yeah.
The last administration did a paltry job in really promoting them. And I don't understand that. I mean, don't get me wrong. Bombardier is very well respected, exceptionally great products. They're based in upstate New York, but hey, we're a little bit further south. Could use a little activity in Kawasaki.
I love you, you're always promoting Yonkers.
Is there anything better? Well, I mean, I just love Bombardier. But I say let them sell planes.
Is it true Yonkers is the second largest city in the
state? No, we're number three now.
Three.
We're climbing. We used to be four. Now we're number three.
So the third largest city in the
country. It's amazing. It's amazing. But, you know, we get eclipsed by that wonderful city just to our border in the south. It's New York City.
I always thought Yonkers was a continuation of New York City.
Well, you know what? There are thoughts. There's a dream by some that Yonkers will become the sixth borough. But yeah. I don't know if those other five boroughs want any part of it. But I'm not so sure. But I think the frightening thing about Yonkers is that the people who ran it for all these years ran it with not the best of intention. Because if you look at Syracuse, for example, it's a city. I think they've got two TV stations. They got three newspapers. We don't have one paper. We don't have one TV station. We don't have one radio station. We got nothing. Because basically, Yonkers has let everybody else usurp, like literally take away their thunder.
Well, what about the Tribune and the Guardian?
Well, we're there. You know, but I mean, you know, they hated us because we were so critical at one point. I don't know if they'll love us today, but even so, we're still fighting for Yonkers. You know what it is? We're not fighting for the powers that be. We're fighting for the city. So that sometimes puts us on the other side of the railroad track, which is where we like to operate anyway. You know, because we'll be doing that whole thing there on the railroad track. It'll be nice. It's exciting.
Books Without Borders is not political.
No, exactly.
Other than the Yonkers City BID has done a wonderful job in putting us all the elements together. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, because you know that's another thing. A lot of people don't realize what the Yonkers Downtown Waterfront bid does, and what they've done is they've been open to this whole concept that you put together, and the beauty of it is also that they're able to facilitate and to traverse all the regulations that are required by the city and by the state, so that and also by the IRS with regard to vendors and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And they put it all together. And if people go to, what is it, bookswithoutborders.com, that's the website address. Or you could look it up in this week's newspaper, the Westchester Guardian. So there's that whole story. You're on the front page. You got a good-looking picture there.
You put a picture. Thank you.
Your picture's on the front. So, which is very nice. And so you can actually connect to it and learn how to become part of this whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that impressed me was the Yonkers City BID at the last two events.
Mm-hmm.
The last one was Riverfest, I believe.
Yeah, and that was all done by Steve Sansone, last-minute thing.
Yeah. And it drew 25,000 people.
Absolutely.
It's incredible.
Well, you know, I think it's really been detrimental that Sansone hasn't done a better job in marketing what he does. You know, that's been one of the big problems always in the city, because people don't really appreciate that he put the Riverfest together in less than 4 weeks.
Wow.
It's like, boom, we're going to do it at the last minute, because the idiots at City Hall didn't figure out that they were going to do it. They were wavering back and forth. Should we? Shouldn't we? He was able to put it all together, and naturally he lives and breathes for 25 hours a day to do this stuff. And then you got people who are very derogatory of his efforts because they don't understand the pressures that go on. And the question is, well, what is the bid supposed to do? The bid is supposed to promote the area, to make sure it's safe, to have the lighting in place, to try to get paving when it needs to be done, to fix this, to fix that, and to keep to keep it going and to drive people to the area.
Right, to help business.
To help business. And, you know, the fact that the authors are going to be doing this little walkabout, you know, to the different restaurants, will introduce people to the different restaurants, introduce them to the authors, introduce them to the books. I mean, it doesn't get better than that. And the fact that it could be, you know, a family value type of day where you could bring the kids and books for the kids. I love this part.
I do too. This is my favorite part. We're Ella Fitzgerald Park.
Yeah.
Which is right in front of the MTA station.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of enclosed.
Yeah.
So it's it was a good place for us to put the children's book office. And we will have face painters and clowns and music for the children in that little area.
Isn't that great? I love that.
And then we're going to have some children's book readings as well in the children's library within the library.
Right.
So that will be nice. But we want to have – it's a family day.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that – and Mr. Sansone has been in agreement and almost insistent on is we have monitored the books that will be and the authors that will be presented. It is a very – it's going to be a very, very interesting place for a family.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing salacious.
Right.
We've tried to make this to be a family event.
Mm-hmm.
We want it to be a recurring family event.
Exactly.
We want everyone from children – we want families to bring their children and let children realize that there's a lot more to – books, and there's a lot more to stories and to storytellers and to this the whole industry and how much your local bookstore, how much fun your local bookstore can be and how much it can be part of your life.
Right.
We want to first highlight local authors and bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
And then we want to make this an entire interactive An interactive event between the publishing industry and the community.
Right.
Kind of let people know everything that goes on behind the scenes. We want to pull down the green of the old curtain or slide back the curtain and see the people behind there working the controls.
Absolutely.
So it's a great resource for new writers because we want to highlight new writers and unknown writers. We want to allow them to be able to interact with the people that have been in this business long term, with Amazon and with Barnes and Nobles and with distributors and other publishers.
Yeah.
And let them interact and meet agents and just a totally interactive industry event as well as being a community event.
Yeah.
So it should be really interesting. And you've said it to me, and I believe it to be true. This is the largest literary event in Westchester in years.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it'll only get larger and larger and larger.
Absolutely.
As time goes on.
I think people hunger for it. There's something really exciting about, you know, a local crowd. And just make it very personal.
And we were put on the New York State Literary Tree on the events list, which I thought was very...
Well, that's great.
Yeah, that was good. That gave us a lot of acceptance.
Absolutely
was good.
Great. Well, it's also very interesting because we just have to sign the paperwork. Amy Neal, I think she's the one that sent us the paperwork with regard to becoming an archival source for the library system across the country.
Oh, that's super.
So that's going to get done by the end of the week.
Terrific.
So, got to get ready. Oh, and I told you about that section. You know, we're having a special section for the kids because we never really focus so much on the children in the newspaper. So now we have a full page that's really based on literacy and learning and just fun games and
are you going to put it on the back of
the writer's collection?
Terrific.
So they'll be good. I have to convince the publisher. I hope he's listening, but I don't think he is. But I hope he's listening. But you know, we'll have to for that particular week. We're going to have to print up more papers because we have to distribute. My God, what are we going to do?
Well, I'll tell you what.
Hawking Papers.
Your distribution has been pretty good, because when I've looked for one in Chappaqua and Pleasantville,
yeah, we're running out.
They're tough to find. If you don't get it by Wednesday, you're not getting it.
Well, that's why you got to go to the WestchesterGuardian.com website to be able to read it. However, I think as our advertising efforts increase, you know, we should be able to also, well, we need to, you know, you can't increase everything at once, but we need greater advertising, which we are getting now. And we also need to increase the staff for distribution, because it's tough.
Well, as you know, my wife advertises with the Guardian.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's had phenomenal results.
Oh, that's always good. That's always good.
I should have told you that, but she does have phenomenal results with the ad.
Uh-huh.
And I've been trying to promote it myself with people in Northern Westchester, saying, you guys are losing by they advertising the Clipper in Westchester Magazine. They're losing the whole downside of the county, the whole southern part of the county.
Well, you know, that's been the fault of everybody in the south part of the county. And I don't know when we decided to differentiate or where the boundary is between north and south. Biggest mistake in the world. Point is, the north is integral to the south and the south is integral to the north. Maybe there was a time when it was all financial. Speaking to Abby this morning, Abby Luby, and we were talking about the divide. But because that was the old money used to be just here. But you know what? The people who were for the Bronx that moved up to Portchester and Yonkers now moved up to Yorktown and Brewster and so on. You got the same mess all over. They all know each other. They're all relatives. They show up together for Easter and Christmas and Thanksgiving. And they'll either celebrate in New Rochelle or they'll be doing it in Pleasantville. But wherever it is, we really won. And the stuff that's exciting here is exciting there.
Exactly.
And, you know, when you got people up there doing their thing, it excites me down here.
I told my son to advertise with you. You know, he is, I'll put a plug in for him. He owns the complete aquarium in Bedford
Hills. I love that. I remember when you told me about that, I just thought that was the best.
And he should be, he advertises locally. You know, with the Clipper and the Examiner. I said, that's crazy. I said, go with the Westchester Guardian. So it's the entire county.
Well, that certainly would be fun. First of all, I love the idea that it's so eclectic. You know, it's a little different, you know, but I've always wanted like an aquarium where you knew that it wouldn't get cloudy and all that algae and oh my God, and the fish kept dying on my, you know, like I'm trying to reduce my interest in all these wonderful fish. Because I'm saying, well, you know, if I kept it, they'll die in a day, you know. But only an expert really knows how to do this right.
That's not true, actually. Now they have new. He just showed. I just found
really?
Myself. I don't know anything about this.
Oh, okay.
But they have these new units that are completely self-contained.
You're kidding me.
They call them the BioCube.
Uh huh.
And there's another one, Red Sea something, but. All the filtration and the protein things and all the stuff that goes into it is into one unit.
Wow.
So basically it's a plug and play. You know,
that's wonderful. That's for me.
You put the thing, put water in, put some salt in, you stick it in.
And that's boom. It? That's fantastic. It. Wow. We got to talk to your son.
He has entire reefs that he built in these things.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, they are.
Wow.
I've read this. And I always kid him, and he says, I don't know. Mm. Doctors say that if you have a fish tank in your house, your blood pressure will not be as high.
Really?
Because they're relaxing. You sit there and you look at them. Instead of watching TV where somebody's telling you the world's blowing up, you know, you watch these beautiful fish swim around so nice and
it's
quiet.
Great.
You know,
it is quiet. Beautiful. You can get lost in that.
Exactly.
That was the original... you know, computer monitor. Oh, I can't believe it. We're at the end, practically. So we got like 2 minutes left. So what should we say? It's June 9th.
June 9th.
It's from 10 to 4. Okay, 10 to 4.
It starts at the Riverfront Library.
Mm-hmm.
It'll promenade in front of Xavier's X2O.
Right.
And the Dolphin.
Yeah.
And Ella Fitzgerald Park.
Right, for the kids.
There's parking all over downtown. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to be a beautiful day. It's you have the view of the city into the south,
mm-hmm.
and the Westchester and the Highlands to the. It's beautiful.
I think it's great.
It's
and
a great day.
And it's Yonkers. What was the website again? I forgot.
YonkersBooksWithoutBorders.com.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It's community.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's beautiful. And it's great. And if for whatever reason people want to look it up, they could find it again with your picture on the front page of this week's Westchester Guardian. So you have to go out and run and get it by Tuesday or Wednesday.
Or they won't have it.
Oh, you won't have it. But you'll be able to print it out online. Sorry.
I'll be happy to tell you that. I know they come out on Tuesday.
Okay.
I looked at one of your boxes in front of Starbucks in Chappaqua, and it was full.
Okay.
On Wednesday morning.
Uh-huh.
Thursday morning, I went back to...
Oh, that's great. Well... We got to print more is what we're saying here.
Exactly.
So I hope everybody's here and we're going to have to print more. Thanks so much. We'll speak to you tomorrow when Richard Narog will be on. So you'll know the banter back and forth and James Smith from Vaughan College. Take care, folks, and thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.